I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
In the eyes of the crown, you are nothing. You're just colonists.
Liberty is not built on the doctrine that a few nobles have a right to inherit the earth. No! Many of our rights are inherent and essential, agreed on as maxims and established as preliminaries even before Parliament existed. We have a right to them.
We don't need a birthright. We don't need a family crest. And we certainly don't need the king's damn permission. What we need is a fair and equal chance. The freedom to live our lives the way that we see fit. And the confidence that that freedom cannot be taken away from us. That is our God-given right.
That is liberty.
What fraction of the human race today lives in free societies?
Tiny, tiny, tiny percentage.
Over history, what fraction at any moment of time ever lived in free societies?
Even tinier.
Even tinier.
While I live, let me have a country. A free country.
And I see a whole army of my countrymen here in defiance of tyranny.
Come on now, freedom calling. Come on over and find yourself.
What will you do without freedom?
I, for one, am willing to fight for it. I'm willing to die for it.
Have you ever read this?
History of the United States.
Well, our Constitution is a masterpiece. James Madison was a genius. The Declaration of Independence is, for me, the single greatest piece of American writing.
Everything in the Bill of Rights, every single aspect of it, was never a restriction on the individual citizen. It never told me what I couldn't do. Everything in the Bill of Rights tells the government what it can't do to restrict my freedom, whether it's my freedom to worship, my freedom to speak, my freedom to assemble, my freedom to express grievances, my freedom to own a firearm and to protect myself and my family, my freedom to be protected from the government breaking into my house in the middle of the night and saying, we want to look through your house without having any particular warrant to do it. There are all kinds of freedoms, and in every one of them, the freedoms are to protect me.
Yeah, sure a lot of writing. Daniel Boone.
Yeah. You know about him?
Well, everybody down Airway knows about Daniel Boone, the first man into the Valley of the Three Forks.
Yeah, he was quite a man. One of the greatest. And that book's full of great men. York, what do you suppose that Boone was looking for when he went out alone into the wilderness?
Well, I never thought much on it.
Was he looking for new lands?
Might be.
Maybe. Maybe for something more. Something that a man just can't see with his eyes or hold in his hands. Something that some men don't even know they have until they've lost it.
Yes, sir?
To be free. Now, that's quite a word, freedom. I think that's what he wanted. I think that's what sent Boone into your Tennessee country.
Is that what this here book's about?
Yep. That's the story of a whole people's struggle for freedom. From the very beginning until now. For we're still struggling. It's quite a story, York. How they all got together and set up a government. Whereby all men were pledged to defend the rights of each man. And each man to defend the rights of all men.
You done give me a powerful lot to be a-thinking about. The man who thinks must think and act on his own. The reasoning mind cannot work under any form of compulsion. It cannot be subordinated to the needs, opinions, or wishes of others. It is not an object of sacrifice.
What is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has not. Not to say the things he truly feels, and not the words of one who kneels.
Our country, uniquely for the time, was founded on mistrust for the government.
You and I, who have been lucky enough to have been born in a free society, take freedom for granted as if it's a natural phenomenon.
Boys forget what their country means by just reading the land of the free in history books. When they get to be men, they forget even more. Liberty is too precious a thing to be buried in books, Miss Saunders. Men should hold it up in front of them every single day of their lives and say, I'm free to think and to speak. My ancestors couldn't, I can. And my children will. Boys ought to grow up remembering that.
We live in a free country. You know, we say that a lot, but I think sometimes we forget really what that means. So listen to it again. We live in a free country.
Come on now, freedom calling. Come on in and remind yourself.
We're asking that there be no restrictions on the content of speech save those provided by the courts. And that's an enormous amount of freedom.
Freedom means to be able to do what you wish, when you wish to do it, as long as it's within the limits of law and ethics and morality.
But there is a price for that freedom, which is that sometimes we have to tolerate things that we don't necessarily like.
Look at Federalist Paper 45. When James Madison was writing Federalist Paper 45, he was trying to convince the citizens of New York to ratify the Constitution. And they were afraid to ratify the Constitution. And he said, the powers that we've delegated to the federal government are few and well-defined and restricted mostly to external affairs. The powers left with the people in the state are indefinite and numerous. If you turn that upside down, we have what we have now. The powers of the federal government are indefinite and numerous.
Can you say why America is the greatest country in the world?
Freedom and freedom. So let's keep it that way.
It's freedom to work at the job you like. Freedom of speech and to peaceably assemble. Freedom to own property. Security from unlawful search or seizure.
Where's your warrant, Flatfoot?
The right to a speedy and public trial. Protection against cruel punishments and excessive fines. And the right to vote. It is these freedoms that have made America strong.
If we do not maintain the essential features of the society which made that freedom and prosperity possible, there isn't a wide range of alternatives. We go to misery and tyranny, to the normal state of mankind.
Patriot must always be ready to defend his country, because the truth often poses a threat to power.
Which way are we moving, tiny steps at a time? Are we headed towards more personal liberty or towards more government control over our lives?
Don't look now, young man, but somebody has his hand in your pocket. It's the hand of big government. It's taking away about 4 months' pay from what your daddy earns every year, $1 out of every three in his paycheck.
With an innocent-sounding constitutional amendment, the 16th, which says that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, and we forgot to put any limit on the extent to which we could tax ourselves. Conceivably, we could be taxed out of all private property. We could be taxed not 70%, 80%, 90%, but 100%. We could awaken one morning and find that the government owns the farm and the house and the car and has a mortgage on the church, legally. Historically, whenever any nation has taxed its people more than 25% of their national income, initiative was destroyed and that nation was headed for economic eclipse.
It slowly but surely destroys individual initiative and responsibility. Government must draw its strength from the people. And as it drains away this strength, it must inevitably undermine the foundations of self-government.
History says we'll roll forward on momentum for a little while, but we'd better get some more gas in the tank pretty quick.
Here's the answer to your problems. Dr. Utopia's sensational new discovery, ism.
Ism will cure any ailment of the body politic. It's terrific. It's tremendous. Once you swallow the contents of this bottle, you'll have the bountiful benefit of higher wages, shorter hours, and security. Enormous profits, no strikes. Remember, you're the big boss.
Almost all of the wealth and much of the income is going to the people on top.
Who is society? We are. Man can be permitted to exist only in order to serve others. He must be nothing but a tool for the satisfaction of their needs.
Government control, no worry about votes. Name your own salary. Bigger crops, lower costs. Why, ism even makes the weather perfect every day.
Public colleges and universities tuition free.
Ordinary citizens know that I'll do everything in my power to protect the underprivileged, the underpaid, and the underfed.
And now then, because we are introducing this amazing item for the first time in this country, it isn't going to cost you 1 cent. All you have to do is sign this little scrap of paper, and you get your bottle absolutely free.
I hereby turn over to ISM Incorporated everything I have, including my freedom and the freedom of my children and my children's children, in return for which said ISM promises to take care of me forever.
If you ask government for extra services, government, in order to perform its increasing function, has to get bigger, right? And as government gets bigger, in order to support its increasing size, it has to what? Tax the individual more. So the individual gets littler. And to collect the increased taxes requires more tax collectors, so the government gets bigger. In order to pay the additional tax collectors, it has to tax the individual more, so the government gets bigger and the individual gets littler. And the government gets bigger and the individual gets littler. Until the government is all-powerful. The individual is hardly anything at all. The government is all-powerful. The people are cattle.
There are two ways to acquire wealth. I mean, you can work for it, you can produce something that your fellow man wants, you can produce some service, or you can steal it from him. I mean, that's basically it. Those are the two ways. They're mutually exclusive. You can get it voluntarily, or you can steal it. And given that human beings prefer to get the things they want by means of the least possible exertion, well, they're going to prefer to take what Oppenheimer calls the political means of acquiring wealth rather than the economic means. That is, going to the government, getting the government to loot their neighbor.
Let's say in the case of a farmer, is the farmer's having trouble, and if he comes and puts a gun to me and says, give me your money, he's going to go to jail. But if he goes to Washington and gets a congressman to write a law enabling the IRS to take my money, he doesn't go to jail.
The creator stands on his own judgment. The parasite follows the opinions of others. The creator thinks. The parasite copies. The creator produces. The parasite loots. The creator's concern is the conquest of nature. The parasite's concern is the conquest of man. The creator requires independence. He neither serves nor rules. He deals with men by free exchange and voluntary choice. The parasite seeks power. He wants to bind all men together in common action and common slavery. He claims that man is only a tool for the use of others, that he must think as they think, act as they act, and live in selfless, joyless servitude to any need but his own.
When that early pioneer turned his eyes toward the West, he didn't demand that somebody else look after him. He didn't demand a free education. He didn't demand a guaranteed rocking chair at eventide. He didn't demand that somebody else take care of him if he got ill or got old. There was an old-fashioned philosophy in those days that a man was supposed to provide for his own and for his own future. He didn't demand a maximum amount of money for a minimum amount of work. Nor did he expect pay for no work at all. Come to think of it, he didn't demand anything. That hard-handed pioneer just looked out there at the rolling plains stretching away to the tall green mountains and then lifted his eyes to the blue skies and said, "Thank you, God. Now I can take it from here." It's just that a few seasons ago, politicians baiting their hooks with free barbecue and trading a Ponzi promise for votes began telling us, "We don't want opportunity anymore. We want security." We don't want opportunity, they said. We want security. And they said it so often we came to believe them. We wanted security. And they gave us chains, and we were secure.
Something's gone wrong. For all our vigilance and battle scars over the Bill of Rights, have we let the flame of freedom's torch grow cold?
People are educated in government-run schools, isn't this an interesting coincidence, which teaches them that the government is their friend and it supplies them with free services and it defends them from their enemies. And they get all this wonderful view of government. So, of course, they believe that we are the government and the government is just my servant. And they believe all this nonsense that has nothing to do with the real world.
When anybody preaches disunity, tries to pit one of us against the other, through class warfare, race hatred, or religious intolerance, you know that person seeks to rob us of our freedom and destroy our very lives.
Have you noticed that as everything around you seems to decline, one thing still grows? It is the power of your rulers. None of their plans and directives have solved your problems or made your life better. The only result has been their increased control over you at the cost of your freedom.
Wouldn't you ever give a second thought to American citizens? You're the reason their money's worthless. You're the reason old people are eating out of garbage cans and kids get killed in bullshit wars. You're an ivory tower hoodlum, a common street killer.
Maybe we need to stop waiting for the government to step in and save us, and we need to start saving ourselves. I mean, this is America.
The truth is the most important value we have, because if the truth does not endure, if the government murders truth, if we cannot respect the hearts of these people, then this is not the country in which I was born in, and it's certainly not the country that I want to die in.
Well, I think it's time we ask ourselves if we still know the freedoms that were intended for us by the founding fathers.
What if the Constitution no longer applied? What if the whole purpose of the Constitution was to limit the government? What if Congress's enumerated powers in the Constitution no longer limited Congress, but were actually used as a justification to extend Congress's authority over every realm of human life? What if the president, meant to be an equal to Congress, has instead become a democratically elected, term-limited monarch? What if the president assumed that everything he did was legal just because he's the president?
When the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
What if he could declare war on his own? What if he could read your emails and your texts without a search warrant?
The NSA specifically targets the communications of everyone.
What if he could kill you without warning? What if the federal government decided if its own powers were proper and constitutional? What if the Constitution were no longer the supreme law of the land? What if you needed a license from the government to speak, to assemble, or to protest against the government? What if the government didn't like what you planned to say and so it didn't give you the license? What if the right to keep and bear arms only applied to the government?
The right to keep and bear arms is a sacred right. It is a natural right. It is in the same category of speech and press and religion and travel and privacy. Why do we need a permission slip from the government to protect ourselves when we don't need a permission slip from the government for our other rights?
What if you were not secure in your person, in your papers, and in your property? What if federal agents could write their own search warrants in defiance of the Constitution? What if voting didn't mean anything anymore because both political parties stand for big government?
There is no party. There are no voices to offer an actual pro-capitalist, laissez-faire, economic freedom and individualism. That is what this country needs today.
What if the government could write any law, regulate any behavior, and tax any event? The Constitution be damned. What if the government was the reason we don't have a Constitution anymore? What if you could love your country, but hate what the government has done to it? What if sometimes, to love your country, you had to alter or abolish the government? What if Jefferson was right? What if that government is best which governs least? What if I'm right? What if the government is wrong? What if it is dangerous to be right when the government is wrong? What if it is better to perish fighting for freedom than to live as a slave? What if freedom's greatest hour of danger is now?
If all of you vow not to surrender the habits of liberty, to speak freely, to act freely, to live freely, they cannot prosecute us all. And if they decide to go full Charlie Hebdo, they cannot kill us all.
Make government more the servant and not the master of us all. In this free nation, we do not choose to be ruled. We elect to be governed.
show this world that this is still a government of the people, for the people, and by the people.
If you want to live by the judgment of your own mind, not edicts from the state, do not support your own oppressors. Stop letting the system exploit you. To everyone within the range of my voice, you now have a choice to make. If you decide to support the notion of sacrifice enforced by the state, your game is up. Your world is in a downward spiral, and you will ride it down to destruction.
You know, this used to be a hell of a good country. I can't understand what's going wrong with it.
Man, everybody got chicken, that's what happened, man. You think we're gonna cut their throat or something, man? Like, they're scared, man.
Oh, they're not scared of you. They're scared of what you represent to them. What you represent to them is freedom.
What the hell's wrong with freedom, man? That's what it's all about.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's what it's all about, all right. But talking about it and being it, that's two different things. Oh, yeah, they're going to talk to you and talk to you and talk to you about individual freedom. But they see a free individual, it's going to scare them.
No, well, don't make them running scared.
No, it makes them dangerous.
What should be the fundamental guidelines for what government should be doing and shouldn't be doing in our free society?
Well, I kind of go back to a first principle, and the first principle was enunciated by John Locke, who played a great role in the influencing the founding fathers in writing the Constitution. And that is, each of us own ourselves. That is, we own ourselves. It's wrong for somebody to own another person. Now, if you agree that each of us owns ourselves, well, you also have to agree that in order to make self-ownership meaningful, then you must own what you produce. That is, if someone else, for example, owned 100% of what you produce, you'd be merely a slave. Now, it turns out that the average American works from January 1st until May 8th to pay federal, state, and local taxes. That is, somebody else decides how close to 5 months the fruits of his labor is used. I think that, and a lot of that is not for things that people use. That is, if you look at the federal budget, 2/3 of federal expenditures constitute an activity where the government, through intimidation, threats, and coercion, confiscates the property that belongs to one American and gives it another American to whom it does not belong. I think that is an immoral function of government.
And Tax Freedom Day gets later every year, right? So every year we seem to be working longer for somebody else, and we have no choice in this. If you don't pay your taxes, you get into trouble.
We have to ask ourselves, can one make a moral case for confiscating the property that belongs to one person and giving it to another to whom it does not belong? Can you make a moral case? Because after all, that's what thieves do. That is, they confiscate the property of one person, or economists call it income redistribution. That's right, what thieves do. They do
that
too.
That's right.
But can we? I think there's a basic question. Can one make a moral case, or is it constitutionally authorized for the government to take that which belongs to one person and give it to another to whom it does not belong? I'm saying, like, I mean, to put it in concrete, that is, where the government takes your earnings and gives it to a farmer, or gives it to an Egyptian, or gives it to somebody else.
In a free society, people decide what they want their government to do. And one of the things that our society has decided over the years is it wants a certain amount of income redistribution. I mean, the fundamental principle in a free society should be that people should decide what it is they want their government to do. And they have settled this question, I'd say, generally, though not in the specifics that you speak.
I think we probably ought to point out that taxes are negative incentives. Anything you tax, you are going to get less of. So if you tax work or saving or driving too fast with tickets, which we like to tax speeding, or we try to, whatever you tax, you're going to get less of. And of course, whatever you subsidize, if you have a negative tax on it, you're going to get more of. And that is an issue of redistribution, in the sense that if we're going to take money from Walter and give it to you, Bill, we have to tax him, and tax him at a different rate, obviously, than we're going to tax you. And he's wondering why we should do that. Why is that an appropriate function for government?
There's two different issues that you're raising. One is the moral question, which is what Walter's been focusing on, and also the incentive question about, will this tax, increased tax on Walter Williams, reduce his work effort or his savings? Now, I happen to know Walter Williams, and that will not happen. Walter worked just exactly as hard, whether that his tax rate is high or low. It depends. We do have to have taxes, and the incentive issues have to be addressed. But our job is really to find those places in the economy where the incentive effects will be minimized.
Frederick Bastiat wrote a little book called The Law. He's a 17th century French philosopher. And he gave us a test to decide whether government was doing something immoral or illegitimate. And he said, ask yourself the question, if I did the same thing individually, would I be condemned as a criminal? That is, for example, I could see some elderly lady sleeping out on the grate downtown Philadelphia, and I could walk up to either you or Bill, and I could come up to you with a gun, and I could say, give me your $200. Then, having gotten your $200, I could go down and help the lady, get her some housing. Yeah. Now, would I be guilty of a crime? Yes, I would. Now, I'd be guilty of behaving immorally. Now, does an immoral act all of a sudden become a moral act because there is a consensus? That is, just because a majority goes for it. Mm-hmm. See, I disagree. I say that just because we vote for something does not establish its morality. And that's what we're trying. That's what we're talking. That's what the framers were trying to look for. They were asking, give us a government that's moral. And you find no constitutional authority for 2/3 of what our federal government is doing. The courts have ruled it constitutional, mm-hmm. but it's not in the Constitution. I've looked carefully.
And in fact, one of the major concerns that the government had in framing the Constitution was the tyranny of the majority, to protect the rights of minority groups, and to make sure that the majority is always asking the moral question. Is this really right? Just because most of us want to vote for it because maybe we benefit from it. And that's certainly a very, very interesting issue. Well, one of those transfers is taking place. I mean, we do have subsidies to farmers and subsidies to the housing industry, for example.
College students.
We have a lot of subsidies that are built into the federal system. And we another big transfer that's been taking place that we have to raise taxes for, that's become very controversial, and that is interest on the debt and the deficit. Certainly the deficit has become one of the major issues in the last decade or so.
The most recent data that I was just looking at in Dr. Dunkelberg's office indicates that we're still sputtering along, and there may be a genuine need for the new president to pursue a more expansionary fiscal policy, which may of necessity mean an increase in the deficit. And it may be what I'm saying is that there may be more important issues facing the American people than just the matter of the deficit and how much interest we pay on it.
Of course, in early 1990, we employed a record high percentage of the population, I think 63.1%. Never as a high percentage of our people been employed before. We had a record high percentage of the population with two jobs. We were certainly fully employed. We couldn't have, if more jobs had been demanded, we couldn't staff them. Right. We'd hired everybody we could get to work.
Right.
And yet the deficit was hundreds of billions of dollars at that point in time. So certainly the economy was fully utilized at that time, and yet there we were running these amazing deficits.
Well, it was not because of revenues. We were engaging in bread and circuses, that we were just spending, and we will never get the deficit under control until we find out what to do with spending. And let's look at the record. I mean, within the last 30 years, we've had one balanced budget, I believe in 1969 mm-hmm. or 68. Now, in 1974, we had the Budget Control Act that was supposed to get the deficit under hand. In 1978, we had the Balanced Budget Act. which made balanced budget the law of the land. Then, of course, we all remember the Graham-Rudman Act that was supposed to get the deficit down to zero by 1992. And then we remember the 1986 the largest tax increase in U.S. history at the time, which was called the down payment on the deficit. Then we had the 1990 budget deal that was supposed to have the five-year deficit reduce it, the $500 billion five-year deficit reduce it to zero. And instead, it's over a trillion now. And all this time, taxes have been going up. We'll never deal with the deficit until we can get government back into the bottle. That is to get the federal government doing its constitutionally authorized functions.
Don't you think this all is tied to a very unrealistic view of the electorate? I mean, I feel that the electorate is largely to blame for this in the sense that we are a nation of people who want the government to do something for us and we want someone else to pay for it. And this idea just is pervasive in the society, and it makes it very difficult for the elected representatives of the electorate to deal with the problem that you described.
Oh, you're 100% correct. That is, Americans are getting exactly what we're asking for.
Right.
That is,
we want something for nothing.
We can't blame politicians because politicians are merely doing what Americans tell them to do. And what do Americans tell politicians to do? They say, we're going to elect you to the Senate or to the state legislature. Right. To use the power of your office to confiscate the property that belongs to one American and
give
it back.
Bring it home. Exactly right. And indeed, if you look at the trends in tax revenues over time, Americans are not really in the tax burden that's falling on a typical American, if you combine state and local taxes, has not really increased all that much. So in many respects, these concerns seem to me a little bit exaggerated when you put them into a temporal and spatial context.
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether temporal, because at the turn of the century in 1902,
right,
the average American paid $60 a year in federal,
right,
state, and local taxes.
Right. And
in fact, they worked, I think, something like not quite a month. But one of the reasons why, you know, if you say, look, our taxes are much lower than the rest of the world, industrialized nation. Well, no wonder the rest of the world wants to buy America. Mm-hmm. That is, they want to, they're rushing to bring their capital over here.
Right.
They're willing to invest in America because we have a more robust economy as a result of the lower tax rate. So I'm not willing to say, look, let's be like Sweden.
A lot of us feel we're paying taxes and we're not getting
anything
in value in return.
Right.
And that, of course, I think creates the incentive problem and the whole issue of confiscation and
That's right. To go into debt, for our nation to go into debt to fight World War II, nobody can object to that. I mean, that was an essential task, and it made future generations better off. It was an investment.
That's right.
In the
exactly
future.
Right.
Today, we're going into debt, and it's just for bread and circuses. It's for today's consumption. There's no cash flow coming back from it.
Most of us know that whatever our color or condition, we need only to see the hunger in Africa, the blood in Lebanon, or the Berlin Wall to realize we are better off here. Even among free nations, America is blessed. Deep thinkers don't look at it that way. The very phrase 4th of July can bring scorn to their faces. Anything the masses believe in is suspect in their eyes. They don't compare the United States to other countries, but to their ideals. Every wrong in this country, past or present, proves to them that it is not worthy of noble creatures like themselves. It never occurs to them that tragic wrongs are found wherever human beings are found. Anyone looking for a sinner need look no further than the mirror. Everything human is a failure compared to ideals. To build a beautiful world of ideals takes only an active imagination, some free time, and a nice vocabulary. But the world people live in is the world of reality. And to make that world decent and free takes much hard work, much sacrifice, and many young men buried under a sea of crosses at places like Normandy and Iwo Jima. Ideals have their value, but ultimately ideal visions are a cheap substitute for reality. For those with a cheap substitute to look down their noses at the real thing is a little much. If America could be summed up in one word, that word would be freedom. Those of us who grew up with freedom may take it for granted, but tens of thousands have died trying to get here for it. In just 1 year, 40,000 people died trying to cross the Atlantic from Ireland alone, back in the days of the sailing ships. Even larger numbers of boat people have perished in the Pacific in our own time. The desire for freedom is so much a part of human nature that politicians and deep thinkers try to call other things freedom in order to sell them. They try to call it economic freedom when the government guarantees you food, shelter, and other basics. Prisons have that kind of freedom. So do communist countries. People try to escape from both, often at the risk of their lives. The freedom of America is the freedom to live your own life and take your own chances. The American Revolution was more than a rebellion against England. It was a rebellion against the whole idea that some special anointed could tell everybody else what to do. The Constitution of the United States is pervaded by the conviction that no one is to be trusted with too much power. Long after kings and dukes have faded into the background, other kinds of the anointed have arisen, convinced that they should be running our lives for us. All sorts of beautiful things are supposed to happen if only we give enough power and money to the new anointed. If only we surrender our freedom to our betters, they will solve our problems and create social justice. Haven't we heard that one before? Too many times? Hasn't it been tried already in too many places, from Nazi Germany to Jonestown? Freedom has to be defended every day against lofty rhetoric as well as military threats. We have to say to the anointed, look, you fellows may have your diplomas and high-toned talk, your good intentions and tables of statistics. You may even have some good ideas and suggestions now and then, and we will follow some of them if we feel like it. But we're not going to let you run our lives. Hey, Mac, we're as good as you are. That's what America is all about.
We're working hard to completely remove groups if they exist primarily to violate our policies or do things that are dangerous.
Groups that do things that are dangerous. What exactly does that mean? Dangerous like hurting other people? Or dangerous as in saying things that Mark Zuckerberg doesn't like?
Danny Ben-David wrote the algorithm at Facebook in 2017, and it was apparently intended to address violence or suicidal content, and we believe that it was applied to politics, and it was used for ill. That seems to be what happened at Facebook.
Sentra is a tool that Facebook uses to track its users, not just on Facebook, but across the entire internet. Sentra tracks different profiles that a user visits, their message recipients, their linked accounts, the pages they visit around the web. Mr. Zuckerberg, how many accounts in the United States have been subject to review and shut down through Sentra?
Senator, I do not know because I'm not actually familiar with the name of that tool. I'm sure that we have tools that help us with our platform and community integrity work. But I am not familiar with that name.
The documents are pretty self-explanatory, and it definitely, I don't know if Mark Zuckerberg knows that these things are happening, but if he does, he was lying under oath.
Right, so wouldn't the sensible thing to do if you were Mark Zuckerberg would be make sure that you don't really know what's going on at your company, so that when you get put in the position where you're under oath, you can basically say anything, and I think this would stand true for Jack at Twitter and a bunch of these guys. If the buck never stops with you, and I'm sure you saw Jack from Twitter on mm-hmm. with Joe Rogan and Tim Pool, and it was like, he just struck me as, oh, I don't really know what's going on with my company, but that seems like it's by design. That's not an accident.
Do you have a tool that does exactly what I've described and that you can see here over my shoulder? Or are you saying that doesn't exist?
Senator, I'm saying that I'm not familiar with it.
How many times have you blocked Republican candidates for office, their tweets or their posts in 2016 and 2018 and 2020? How many times have you blocked Democratic candidates for office? How many times have you blocked Republican office holders? How many times have you blocked Democratic office holders? Twitter has repeatedly refused to answer that question with specific hard data and cataloging the examples. In the interest of transparency, which you said you want to embrace, will you commit in this hearing right now to answer those questions in writing?
We're going to work to answering broader transparency around outcomes.
All right, that's a no. Mr. Zuckerberg, how about you? Will you commit that Facebook will answer those specific questions, cataloging the number of instances in which Democrats in 16, 18, and 20 have been silenced versus the number of instances in which Republicans have been silenced on Facebook?
Senator, I'm not sure if we have that data available.
Twitter is now an independent nation state with its own National Security Council, an interagency constellation of foreign policy experts. So the global public policy people weighed in today, as security councils do, on the upcoming elections in Uganda. And here's what they said about those elections. Quote, ahead of the Ugandan election, we're hearing reports that internet service providers are being ordered to block social media and messaging apps. We strongly condemn internet shutdowns. They are hugely harmful, violate basic human rights, and the principles of the hashtag open internet. Access to information and freedom of expression, including the public conversation on Twitter, is never more important than during the democratic processes, particularly elections, end quote. So marinate in that a bit. Just let it sink in. Twitter is reminding the Ugandan people that censorship is immoral.
Was Twitter being a publisher when it censored the New York Post?
No, we have very clear policies on the conduct we enable on the platform. And if there's a violation, we take enforcement action, and people choose to commit to those policies and to those terms of service.
Except your policies are applied in a partisan and selective manner. You claim it was hacked materials, and yet you didn't block the distribution of the New York Times story that alleged to talk about President Trump's tax returns, even though a federal statute makes it a crime to distribute someone's tax returns without their consent. You didn't block any of that discussion, did you?
Our policy was focused on distribution of the actual hack materials.
Did you block the discussion of the president's tax return material?
And in the New York Times case, we interpreted it as reporting about the hack materials.
Did you block Edward Snowden when he illegally released material?
I don't have the answer to that.
The answer is no. Let me ask you, were you being a publisher when you forced Politico and other journalistic outlet to take down their tweets on a topic that you had deemed impermissible?
No. We were enforcing our policy and our terms of service.
I know insiders that I get some information from. I mean, I'm talking about Google, Facebook, Twitter, like that. Really, these things have become so huge that now their own people inside them are going, whoa, what did we help create here?
What did these former Facebook employees tell you?
So what they told me was that there was a system in place that allowed them to either blacklist or inject stories that weren't trending into the newsfeed. So in a sense, there were human curators that were actually, affecting what was showing up on Facebook's trending news feed. For the last 2 years, Facebook has maintained that it's been an algorithm that's sorting these topics. So we obviously found these revelations to be pretty interesting, to say the least. For the last 2 years, they've been saying an algorithm is doing this sorting. We have found that actually a small group of 20 journalists that are recent graduates from East Coast private schools and often Ivy League schools are the ones that are actually activating a trend so that it can show up in your feed or blacklisting it. These young journalists are the ones that are choosing what trends and what doesn't. And the question then becomes whether you trust recent graduates to determine what the most important news of the day is.
Big tech exercises massive power. It also enjoys massive corporate welfare. Through the effect of Section 230, a special immunity from liability that nobody else gets. Congress has given big tech, in effect, a subsidy while they become some of the wealthiest corporations on the face of the planet. Mr. Dorsey, I want to focus primarily on Twitter and ask you initially, is Twitter a publisher?
Is Twitter a publisher?
Yes.
No, we are not. We distribute information.
So what is a publisher?
An entity that is publishing under editorial guidelines and decisions.
Well, your answer happens to be contrary to the text of federal statute, particular section 230.
Did you find any evidence of political bias being applied the other way on liberal sites like MSNBC.com or Daily Kos or Think Progress?
No, we didn't find any evidence of that. But, you know, at least in one instance, we had a source that was maintaining a list for the course of a six month period in which he found items like Chris Kyle, Ted Cruz, Mitt Romney, and a variety of other conservative news topics that were blacklisted by Facebook's news curators.
Facebook released its latest enemies list. Alex Jones, Milo Yiannopoulos, Paul Joseph Watson, Louis Farrakhan, Laura Loomer, all of them were designated dangerous individuals and banned from Facebook and from its subsidiary Instagram. Alex Jones's company InfoWars was banned as well and described as a dangerous organization. How dangerous is InfoWars? Well, Facebook believes it's so dangerous that you can be banned from using the platform, Facebook, just for sharing its content unless you simultaneously denounce it. Let that penetrate for just one moment. Think about it, just for a second. Mark Zuckerberg is not simply censoring opinions. He's prescribing which political opinions you're allowed to have, which conversations all of us in this country can have about America. Keep in mind that nobody voted for Mark Zuckerberg. People don't know that they're being lied to by CNN and the New York Times, and they don't know that they're being de-boosted and shadow banned by Twitter and Facebook. It's not so bad if they take your account down and restore it. Mm-hmm. But the thing that's really scary about the deboosting and the shadow banning is that you don't know that it is happening to you. And
right,
what
you can kind of see it. You can kind of feel it. There are times when everything I'm doing is on fire, and then sometimes where it's just like nothing happens. And those usually have a certain political bent to them. And then you end up really feeling like you're in a mental institution, because if you don't have evidence of anything, I don't want to be the guy that's running around screaming everything's a conspiracy and they're coming after me.
We have videotape after tape of people inside Twitter, including the Twitter direct messaging guy, saying that they have certain keywords and they consider you to be a Russian bot if you tweet about God, guns, and the American flag.
Any inquiry into big tech's censorship practices must take an especially hard look at Google. Google's control over what people hear, watch, read, and say is unprecedented. Almost 90% of internet searches in the United States use Google. Type a few letters into the search bar, and Google will tell you what you should be looking for. The same is true of Google's subsidiary, YouTube, the second most visited web page in existence. When you search on YouTube, programs written by people at YouTube provide you with the results. When you watch a video, a program written by the people at YouTube suggests what you should watch next. And when you submit a video, people at YouTube determine whether you've engaged in so-called hate speech, an ever-changing and vague standard meant to give censorship an air of legitimacy.
At the end of the day, these companies don't like an independent people influencing the minds of other people. That's what this is really about. Here's the most amazing thing of all. Our media think that's great. Listen to them celebrate Mark Zuckerberg and sell you out completely.
Alex Jones has been banned from Facebook for a long period of time, but now they banned him. They banned his like little underling, Paul Joseph Watson.
Now that they kicked them off the platform, that's great for now, but it doesn't roll back the clock.
I have no issue with it at all. I want them shut down. I want them silenced. I want them muted. I think they are horrible for our society.
Last week, the Democratic Party chairman, Tom Perez, met with a Council on Technology and Society. This council included the CEO of the tech company TaskRabbit, among others. According to a summary of the meeting that we received, the group bluntly asked Tom Perez, again, the head of the Democratic Party, what they could do to, quote, contribute to the broad social good. When you ask that question to the head of the Democratic Party, what are you asking? How can we elect Democrats? which is what they're trying to do.
People have to remember that these companies are publicly traded companies. They get their broadcast license from the FCC in some circumstances. There's sort of entanglements. There's a symbiotic relationship between the corporate press and the government. It's going to require outsiders to blow the whistle because no one in the government is going to do it. Indeed, many of them are on the take.
A coalition of major companies, including Verizon, NBC, Facebook, and Google, the biggest companies, has announced a new Global Alliance for Responsible Media. Remember that, Global Alliance for Responsible Media. Now, the stated goal is to pressure tech platforms to, quote, develop and deliver against a concrete set of actions, protocols, and processes for protecting people and brands, blah, blah, blah. In other words, what they're really saying is censorship, and censorship on a vast scale. If they have their way, this will be the end of free speech online and the death, by the way, of mainstream conservatism.
Big tech's algorithms and search engines only do what humans at companies like Google tell them to do.
Any voice right of center will be tarred as hate speech, Russian trolls, or simply bad for business. That's their game plan.
The big tech companies have more power than government. They are more powerful than all three branches of government. Somehow we need to hold these people accountable. They're not held accountable by anybody. Who elects them?
Just as big tech needs and wants data on all of us, the American people need and want data on big tech. They need it to profit. We need it to protect free speech.
The point is to establish control. They know that they can dictate what you have the right to say about trans rights or mask mandates. They can dictate what you can say about anything. That's unprecedented power. No one in this country has ever had that power. Our Constitution used to prevent it, but they have it now. And that power will come in handy when they're running the government.